Hi, welcome to another episode of Duck on Pork. In this episode, I'm honored to have a new guest, Tim Davis. Tim is a Columbia Physics PhD turned Korean VC. And in this episode, he's going to talk about his experience as a VC in Korea, his experience as a PhD student at Columbia, and his various other adventures in countries like China and elsewhere. So please join me in welcoming Tim Davis. So Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What is your favorite Korean food?
Favorite Korean food? That's a good question. It's got to be the barbecue. It's got to be the barbecue. Don't ask me which type, but definitely Korean barbecue is.
Got it. That's what we had last time too. I remember.
We just kind of wandered around Shinsen and ended up going into this place, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't bad, right?
Yeah, and I remember distinctly that time. Actually, we had two Japanese women sitting next to us, and you recognized that they were Japanese, and I didn't. And that was interesting.
That's right. And they were freaking out over the menu. Because they were, I guess, too, like, scared to communicate with the waiter, or so they had, like a huddle as to what to do. And then, and then the waiter came over, and it got really awkward. And didn't we even say, like, should we help them? But I think you had just come from Japan, or no, Thailand was it.
I think I came from Japan, but I was going to Thailand after that.
That's right. And so I think we were like, oh, should we, like, help them? And then we're like, nah, I don't think our Japanese is of caliber to help these poor ladies.
Okay, Tim, so we were talking about that dinner that we had the other time in Seoul, right? That Korean barbecue place.
That's right.
And you mentioned your favorite food is Korean barbecue.
Indeed.
And
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, sorry.
No, so I was going to say, I remember we did quite a few interesting things that day, because before that dinner, we actually walked around. I forget the name of that area, that street. We went into like this cool sunglass shop where they were selling like a few like sunglasses that were red. But like there was a bunch of other random stuff going on in there. There's like poultry. There's like meat shop or something, and there's like a bunch of random like furniture in there.
Yeah, that's right. So we were walking around the street called Karusugi, I think now is oddly in a bit of a decline, but maybe when I had just arrived in Korea, so it's about three and a half years ago, that was one of the sort of really hot places for young people to just, you know, stroll around and sort of be seen. And there's a large street clothes, street photography presence there, and there was this one sort of massive coffee shop that had a open front, so people would, you know, just kind of sit there and show off or watch people pass by. The street is still quite popular, as you know, you remember walking by, but I think it's definitely become a bit less so. I think generally the trend in Korea tends to move very, very quickly. So an area that's popular today might be not so popular, you know, in a year. And some really random area that no one cares about all of a sudden becomes, you know, the trend center after that.
I see.
But still, I think that place is quite popular. And the shop that we went into was, I think, one of the really rapidly developing homegrown Korean brands. It's called, I believe, Gentle Monster.
Gentle Monster.
I believe it's called Gentle Monster.
Okay, it's like a oxymoron. Which is
a bit of an odd name, but their whole style, their whole promotion is quite odd. That shop looked like a house, right?
Yeah.
They change the interior every once in a while, but like I think there's like a kitchen that has like fully working, you know, whatever, utensils and all that. And then just sprinkled throughout are these sunglasses that, you know, are a bit out of place. And it's funny because you think about, wow, this land is incredibly expensive, right? This is one of the most expensive
neighborhoods,
you know, areas of Seoul,
right?
And then they buy this massive building, right? And then they have, you know, 10 pairs of sunglasses in a room that's, you know, 100 square feet or more, and you're just like, wow, you know, this must be successful and expensive, which I guess is sort of, you know, their value proposition is almost like, look at how great we are. Like, we can put 10 sunglasses into this massive room and also fill it with, like, random stuff.
I guess it feels a bit like a painting you see in MoMA, and it's just a blank canvas, and the title is untitled, and it's like $5 million or something like that, right?
Exactly. And look, they're doing really, really well. I've heard that they are expanding. They've already expanded outside of Korea into other Asian countries. And I'll tell you a kind of funny story. A friend of mine is from Kazakhstan.
Okay.
And she came here, she visited, she fell in love with this brand. Hmm. She bought a pair, and she does trade. So she was like, oh, let me see if I can import these into Kazakhstan, because I think there's a market there. And she found out someone already had the rights.
Oh, wow.
You know, so these guys are doing quite well. And this was about a year ago. So, you know, this wasn't like yesterday.
Hmm.
And they already apparently had a presence, or at least someone who was willing to contract with them to sell in Central Asia, of all places.
So right? Do you know anybody that has personally actually bought things from them? Because when we actually visited, I remember there were a lot of tourists there, or people taking pictures there and posing in front of these things. But, I mean, I just don't know if people actually bought stuff there. Do you know anybody?
Yeah. So the Kazakh girl that I mentioned has several pairs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a couple other girls I know, vaguely I remember them buying maybe a pair each.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's sort of their, you know, I think they're priced at a point where not every person who comes in is going to buy it. But, you know, if they sell, if they have a very specific market that they sort of know can sustain them, I guess, and that's sufficient. So they spread through word of mouth by having this odd sort of location. And then, you know, every once in a while, someone of means who loves this kind of stuff wanders through and buys.
Got it. So by the way, I remember when we were having that dinner in the Korean barbecue place, you were ordering in Korean. And later that night, we met up with this other friend of yours, right? This Korean guy. And you were talking to him in Korean over the phone as well. So how is your Korean these days? How is the trajectory of your Korean language capabilities over time?
Oh, God. That's a scary question. The trajectory has leveled out, let's say. It's maybe on the decline at the moment.
Oh, no.
Korean is it's kind of a hard language, because every time you progress a bit and feel like, you know, I've accomplished something, you actually realize how little you actually know, right? And it's like those games where, you know, video games where, you know, you start and you're in this small enclosed area and you beat up the boss and you're like, oh, I just did something. And then the map opens up and you're like, oh, shit.
Got it.
There's
got
a lot more that I didn't realize. So that's Korean in a nutshell. And, you know, when I first came here, I worked on Korean really hard, I would say. You know, I tried to study quite a bit. But it sort of waxes and wanes. There was a time when I was dating, there's like a sequence of a couple of girls that I was dating who spoke no English or just very, very little English, to the point where my Korean was further along. And at that point, I you know, very seriously got into the Korean, because it was like our you know, main means of communication. And so I pushed it, you know, I had a tutor who came to my office and all that. But then, you know, we sort of stopped seeing each other, and I kind of slow down my Korean at the same time. And then I would say the main kind of wall was I really got into CrossFit, right? And there's only so many after-school activities that you can have, right? So I sort of like really got into CrossFit and going to the gym and all that. And, you know, at that point, my Korean sort of just moved to the side. And so it's sort of been on the downward trajectory now because I'm sort of forgetting a lot of the stuff that I knew. But I feel like I probably need to, you know, rebalance some of those things and sort of push back into Korean a little bit.
So I remember you told me that you lived in China for summer or something like that.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. And you also studied Chinese before, right?
I didn't formally study Chinese. Okay. When I arrived in China, I literally had to, right? Because this was back in 2000. I think it was four.
Which four, city did you go to, five. By the way?
This was Beijing. Oh, yeah, Beijing, so this okay. was Beijing back in 04, let's say, maybe 04, 05. And I got a summer research fellowship from the NSF, the National Science Foundation,
right.
to do a research project in China at a laboratory in the Chinese Academy of Sciences
uh-huh.
in Beijing. And so I was like, oh, this is fantastic. You know, I love to travel, blah, 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 blah. China seems really great. So I arrive and essentially there was like no project, not really any project in place, right, of course. And no one really to take care of me or anything. So, like, I discovered very early on that I kind of had to fend for myself, right? And the Beijing of today is quite a bit different from the Beijing of a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And so I had this, I think I told you this story, Robbie, maybe not. I had this, like, moment of realization, like, oh, shit, it was the first day, first or second day after I arrived. So I arrived and this guy met me at the airport from the research group that I was supposed to join. And he took me to this, like, let's say dormitory. Okay. It was nicer than a dormitory, but, you know, essentially like housing that mm-hmm. I, like a very cheap hotel room, let's say,
uh-huh.
that like had no flushing toilet and kind of very classic Chinese model, right?
Right.
Where I was supposed to stay. And then he's like, okay, someone will come to pick you up and left. I was like, oh, okay. So I just kind of like hung out there. And at one point I was like, okay, well, I need to get food. So I wander out and there's like a equivalent of a convenience store, you know, down the road.
Uh-huh.
So I go in and I see a container of ramen noodles and I know how that works. So okay. I take the noodles, I go to the counter and I'm like, oh, I need chopsticks. So I make this like chopstick motion with my fingers, you know, okay. like two fingers out, like kind of moving back and forth toward my mouth, and the girl gave me a carton of cigarettes.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, this is not going to be good, right? And then I was like, no, 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 no. And then she looked at me, and then she gave me scissors.
Oh, okay.
I'm not kidding. And then finally chopsticks. And so at that point, I was like, okay, like, you need to learn Chinese, and you need to learn Chinese fast. So the first words that I learned, well, yeah, I learned the numbers and all that kind of on the flight over. But then, like, the first, like, word that I learned upon arrival in China was kuaizi,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
Chopsticks. Yeah, that was quite interesting, because I think necessity is sort of the mother of invention, right?
Yeah.
So by virtue of not having any English around, to be honest, I think the language I used the most in China was Russian, of all things. And then second was Chinese. And then finally, a long distant third was English.
Wait, you used the most as Russian?
Yeah, so I speak Russian.
Oh,
not super well.
Okay.
But, you know, China, I don't know about today, but in those days, there was a very large Russian presence in China. I believe the largest embassy in the world was the Russian embassy in Beijing.
Oh, wow.
That has been replaced now by the U.S. embassy in Iraq, in Baghdad. But I think there's a reason why the U.S. one is large. There's probably 10,000 service members there, like, protecting it. But from a civilian perspective, the Russian one is quite large.
Hmm.
There's a very large Russian or Russian-speaking community, and a lot of Central Asian people are there in Beijing. They do a lot of trade, and they study Chinese and all that. And I mean, I can tell you that this story as well. I don't know if it's within
an
area of interest, but
all fair game.
So basically, to finish this first story and then transition to the second one.
Okay.
I basically was like, okay, I need to learn Chinese. I ended up finding a girl who was a Chinese teacher,
mm-hmm.
Who had just recently finished her education or something, and she was looking to make some pocket money in addition to her kind of full-time job. And we met. I would say I was not a super diligent pupil, but just by virtue of the necessity, right? I picked up a little bit of Chinese. I was really impressed. I still remember, I would jump in the cabs.
Uh-huh.
And these were the old, I don't know, Robbie, have you been to Beijing, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
Like 10 years ago, when was your first trip, I guess?
My first trip was when I was 12. That was like 1990 something. But I also went to Beijing in 2004, actually. I remember there were a lot of accidents on the road. That's one thing I remember, a lot of accidents. But maybe you have a story there. Go ahead.
Well, I wonder, Robbie, if we were there at the same time.
I was
maybe
there
slight
September
overlap.
2004.
I was there in the summer. Close enough. So my legacy persisted into your time. Well, anyway,
exactly.
So as you remember, this was, I think, maybe a year or two after China had won the Beijing Olympics.
Uh-huh.
And so they were full swing into kind of rebuilding Beijing for the Olympics, for the big debut, global debut of Beijing, right? And one of the things was they were replacing the cabs. The old cabs, you remember those old red Citroën, the French cabs that were literally duct taped together, basically. And they were replacing them with the Hyundai, I guess they were Sonatas, right?
Uh-huh.
Or Elantra, I don't remember, whichever one is the like mass produced Hyundai one.
Hmm.
And so the Hyundai ones were a slightly higher price, and the Citroen ones were a little bit cheaper as they were being phased out. So I would always hop into the old Citroen.
Save
a bit of cash, and then I would have these like amazing rides where the car like would stall in the middle of the highway and all that. But what would happen was the cab driver, like, I would try to tell the cab driver in Chinese where to go, and he would then always chat with me, like, "Ni shi na guo ren, ni shi mi guo ren ba," or whatever,
right?
And so as like, basically, as I would continue the conversation, he would drive me straight toward my destination. But whenever like it became clear that I have no idea what he's saying, and the cab drivers would realize that I'm just like a tourist, right?
Uh-huh.
He would drive way off the path and like, do a circuit of Beijing before getting me where I need to go.
Oh, no.
So that was my main motivation for speaking Chinese, was to reduce cab time, duration and cost.
I see.
Because I remember the first one, I called my friend and I told her, please tell the cab driver. And I passed the phone to the cab driver and she told him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, I know where to go.
Oh, no.
And he ended up taking me on the tour of the Forbidden City in Tiananmen Square. He actually stopped like at the entrance to Forbidden City and he's like, that's the Forbidden City. I was like, this is absolutely not close to where I need to be.
Oh my gosh.
And but then like as I got better in Mandarin, like, those commute times decreased. I was very proud of myself. That was sort of how I learned Chinese. Not to say I was good, you know, I was not good. I was able to, you know, do very basic things like take the cab and order some food. But, you know, for a couple months without having had formal education, I was a little bit proud of myself. I even learned a bunch of characters. I think that's actually probably my strength, is memorizing the characters.
Mm.
So within a couple months, I had a few hundred under my belt, but I lost them, you know. I lost them very, very soon after, because I never practiced.
Did you? Although, did you use any techniques to memorize them? Because you seem to have remembered them really quickly, a few hundred in a matter of 2 months. Go ahead.
No, I don't think so. I just kind of...
You just kind of remembered it?
Just kind of went with it.
Huh.
So Chinese, it's fascinating, especially with the characters, because basically you have some characters... So there's some words you know how to say it, but you don't know how it looks.
Right.
Some word you know how it looks, but you don't know how to say it.
Right, that's right. It's not a phonetic language.
Right. And so, like, there were these hilarious situations where, you know... I knew, like, I needed to go to a place that was, like, you know, bright horse, but I didn't know how to say those words, let's say. So I literally, I had an old, like, phone, you know, I got, like, a very, very basic entry-level phone that I could use for text messaging while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you could either type in pinyin, right, where you phonetically... use the English keyboard to write the word, and it'll give you a list of options for the character, or you could draw them.
Right.
And so there were a ton of characters that I had no idea how to say. Hmm. So I would just draw them and, like, you know, and then find the one that looks the most similar on the screen. So it was like this really odd way to learn things, but, you know, it worked in a very non-academic way, you know, in a very practical way.
So where did you stay while you were in Beijing?
So I stayed in the north. So if you know your geography, I stayed in the, like, Beisihuan area.
The fourth ring road
on the north side. I was, I guess, somewhere between Beida, Beijing University, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and the Chinese, I think it's called the Aeronautics University, or
something like that.
It's like Beijing, Hangzhou, Hengtian.
They call them Beihang. Yeah.
So, Beihang. Yeah. That's right.
Exactly.
So I was kind of roughly around there. It was basically a dorm-like housing that various. I think students visiting from different places were staying at, but there were no other. There was one other guy who spoke English, but there wasn't many other folks.
Did you hang out in places like what are those places called?
Wudaokou.
Wudaokou and Sanlitun and these
Sanlitun,
places.
Yeah. Well, so okay, so I'll tell you, this is my, like. This is what kind of, I think, created.
Germinated.
Like the germ of my travel bug came from this.
Okay.
Basically, I was in this weird position where I had this U.S. sort of government, pseudo-government, contract. Well, not contract, but I was getting paid by the government, right, to do this non-existent project. And it was actually kind of cool because they were paying me a massive per diem. It was $80 a day.
Okay, wow.
Regardless, and this was just, I don't know how it's changed, but at the time it was $80 a day regardless where you went. Hmm. And so, as you can imagine, in Beijing a decade ago, $80 is it's like, you know, king money. Like you're living the high life.
Yeah, high roller
and
in town.
So, what?
You're the high roller. In town. Yeah.
and so, like, I was this curiosity because I think I was 20 or how old was I? Yeah, I guess I was 20 years old or so at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had this like fancy sounding role that was fake, but I never told anyone. And I had like a huge amount of money to waste.
Right.
And I spoke Russian and English, which is not the most common of combinations, right, to be honest. And so what happened was within the first couple of weeks, I basically was just exploring Beijing, and I went to a park. I don't remember which one. Maybe it was Hohai, maybe not. I don't remember.
Okay.
And I'm by myself, right, completely isolated as usual. And I hear this gentleman speaking Russian on the phone.
Okay.
And I'm like, I have to talk to this guy. Like, this is it. This is like the first bit of foreign language that I've heard.
Uh-huh.
So I wait for, you know, I kind of see where he is. I, you know, follow behind him for a while. And then I wait for him to finish speaking. And he was also speaking Chinese.
Uh-huh.
That was the interesting thing. And I roll up to him and I'm like, oh, hi. You know, sorry to bother, in Russian. Hi, sorry to bother you. I heard you spoke Russian, blah, 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 blah. And he was looking at me like, the fuck, right? Who the fuck is this guy? And it turned out that he was working at the Russian embassy.
Oh, wow.
He was one of these dudes that, you know, in the biggest embassy in the world. And he spoke very good Mandarin.
Hmm.
Of course, he spoke Russian. That was his first language. He didn't speak English.
Hmm.
And, you know, he must have thought, like, he was clearly a spy. Well, let me preface this by saying...
Oh, wow, really?
You know, the 2,000 guys, there's 2,000 Russians in the Chinese embassy. They're not all, like, cultural attachés, right? Like, like, you know, about half of them have administrative roles, and half of them are just, like, you know, either spies or, like, some other dudes that are supposed to be doing, you know, whatever,
mm-hmm,
various unsundry things. And he was like probably in that latter category.
Hmm.
So first he's like, what the fuck is this kid doing? And then he was like, who the fuck is this kid? Right. Oh, should I not be cursing, by the way? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. It doesn't matter. I don't give a fuck. It's okay.
you can beat me out later. And so he was like, all right, we got to hang out. Cause I thought, I was like, look, I don't know anyone. I don't know anything. I'm like new in town. And he must have like written his report and been like, okay, there's this kid, I'm not sure what he does, but maybe we can learn something. So then me and him started hanging out, and it was kind of like this odd couple, because the guy was like, you know, quite a bit older than me, right? He was probably in his 30s, and uh-huh, I was like 20.
Right.
And so he took me to Sunlitour, among other places, and, you know, he knew all the hot spots and all that, but... it was fun. He was a little bit strange, and like, you know, of course he was like asking like, oh, so, you know, what sort of things are you working on and all that. So, and so I sort of realized that my lifeline was, I gotta like keep kind of like being interesting enough without giving away the secret that I'm just like a fresh sophomore in college. Right.
I see.
So I was like, yeah, you know, there's this research project that I'm doing with the Academy of Sciences. It's, you know, focus on nanotechnology. So that was fun. And then parallel to that, I ended up going to, you know, they have the academy, they have the language university. There was a UN
yes,
doctorate,
yes,
right? And basically someone told me, this was in the mechanics, this was in the Academy of Sciences when I would go to the place where I was supposed to do things and just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me, oh, there's a school not far from here that has, you know, foreign people that's studying Chinese. You know, you might want to go there.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yeah, you know, that's a great idea. So I walked over there and, you know, I met like folks from all over the world that were studying Chinese, and many of them were from English or Russian speaking countries. And I ended up by accident the first day falling in with this group of Russians. And when I say Russians, I'm saying people who are from the country of Russia, but also a lot of Central Europeans. Central Asians.
Right.
You know, former Soviet countries that, spoke Russian as the first language. And so we ended up going out that first day. Like, we went out really hard. Like, we were out all night in Wudakwo, right, which is near the language school.
Right.
And I ended up that first day, I went out with them. I ended up meeting this girl who was a Russian. She's from the eastern part of Russia called Buryatia, which is next to Lake Baikal, the deepest lake in the world.
Oh, wow.
And they're a very fascinating bunch because they look very Mongolian, maybe even Korean, ethnically, but they're Russians. You know, they behave, they speak, they culturally are Russian. And so I met this girl, and like instantly I was like, I kind of fell for this girl. And she she was quite a bit older than me. She was like, I think 26 or 27 at the time. And I remember she asked me, she's like, how old are you? And I didn't realize how old she was. Right. But I figured I need to lie. Right. So I was like, oh, I'm 21. Like, I was adding like a year or two to my age.
Right.
And she was like, oh, okay, I'm like 27. I was like, did I say 21?
Even
my fake age. Even my fake age was significantly lower than her real age. But anyway, so then we kind of started to see each other. And this was perfect because she had in the past at some point been studying Chinese. So she spoke, a very fluent Mandarin and Russian. And so for me, it was a great opportunity to sort of build up my Russian skill, which, you know, honestly was not, you know, it was not something I used very often. But, after a little bit of time, it all kind of came back and you know, do a little bit of Chinese as well. What I didn't realize, and this is like, this is like clearly my like 19-year-old or 20-year-old self in action. She didn't work, or she told me like her job was to like occasionally, you know, help with like Russian tour groups. But she lived in a really fancy place. She lived, in Chaoyangmen. Chaoyangmen, non-Xiaojie, that area.
Okay.
So kind of on the east side of Beijing, where like it was quite well developed. She lived in a nice apartment. And what I discovered right at the end of my trip, thank God it was right at the end of my trip, was that, of course, there was a Russian boyfriend in Moscow who was financing this.
Oh, snap. Okay.
And so I was like, I was the other guy. I was like the little boy toy. Because I think the Russian dude was, you know, older and able to take care of this apartment in China and still have his business or whatever he was doing in Moscow. And basically, you know, I think it was literally the last week I was in China or maybe, you know, even less than a week, she falls off the face of the earth. Like, she didn't pick up the phone and, you know, doesn't contact me or whatever. And at this point, I had met all her friends. So I reached out to a couple of her friends. I was like, oh, what happened? You know, why is she gone?
Right.
And they were like, yeah, about that. And so they kind of told me. I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm leaving the country in a week anyway. So this is probably a good time for me to fuck off before like some big like Russian bruiser comes over and breaks my legs or something. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that was like, I lived this like very like movie, movie like life when I was in China, because I had all these weird situations happening that I accidentally got into the middle of. And sort of in parallel to that, I had this tremendous like income source that like made me appear to be a lot bigger than I am. Right. Because at the time the prices were so cheap. It was like, we would go to nice Russian restaurants, that were not cheap, but basically it was the way that I looked at it was, if you just change a dollar bill, a dollar sign into the renminbi sign, the Chinese currency sign, that was roughly the price. So the absolute number was consistent, but then the exchange rate, of course, made it much cheaper.
Right.
So an entree would cost like 30 renminbi, right? That would be in New York, you know, $30 at sort of the same caliber of restaurant.
Got it.
But at the time, it was 8.15 renminbi to the dollar, so it was a lot less than 30, right?
Right.
And so I could afford to take her out and her friends.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, not even feel it. So I was living this kind of odd baller lifestyle, and it was definitely quite a change for, you know, highly studious 20-year-old engineering student.
So how... There's so many interesting follow-up questions. So did you hang out with any locals, like local Chinese people, while you were there?
So I started to. I did a little bit, but not that much.
Oh.
So basically, the research group that I was supposed to be part of,
mm-hmm.
there were, you know, a few PhD students. It was like a couple professors, a few students. I don't remember if they had any undergrads or not. They might have. They wanted to go out. You know, they wanted to work on their English and all that.
Right.
So we went out a few times.
Okay.
But, you know, it wasn't even a language issue, but there was like quite a large, you know, cultural gap with them. But I really tried hard because I felt like part of my role was not, like, they didn't need me to do research. Like, I had no capabilities that they didn't have.
Uh-huh.
It was to kind of introduce them to have a cultural exchange, really.
Right.
And so I was quite cognizant of that. And so I tried to be very polite to them. And you know, we would go out to lunch or dinner, you know, around the university. And I would tell them, you know, about U.S. and to ask them questions about China and all that. So it was definitely a nice cultural exchange, but I don't think I built the
rapport.
You know, yeah, it was like, okay, let's meet, yeah, but I don't think I had the bonds with them that I ended up building with some of these like random Russian folks.
So sounds like with these Chinese students, it's more like I don't know the right word. It's quote unquote more civil and more polite and more kind of you know, let's get together and formally establish our cultural exchange lessons kind of thing. Whereas with the Russians, it's more like, let's hang out, you know, we're buddies, there's a lot of rapport going on, and you are part of their lives, they're part of your lives, you know, you kind of intermingle and become much closer.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, right? So I was very aware of, you know, my responsibility, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, it wasn't like it was a pain. It was very nice to meet these guys. And
right.
But it was very civil, as you said. And with the Russians, there was this weird bond of, you know, being kind of, you know, foreigners in this very strange, very different society. That we shared, even though we were foreigners from different places, different parts of the world. So it was quite interesting. You know, like for example, several Russian friends invited me to their houses, you know, for dinner parties or just, you know, getting together for a drink or whatever, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chinese students they didn't invite me, but also they were living in the dorms while the Russians were, you know, they had their own little businesses,
their own quarters,
and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So there was that. And then parallel to that, one of the professors asked me to go to her class a few times and meet the students. So the professor was, of course, also teaching a class. And so I met the students and the kind of, you know, the students were very excited. These were undergrads,
mm-hmm.
very excited to speak in English. The ones that felt comfortable, who had, you know, been working very hard on their English, were
right.
very excited to chat. And, you know, they presented their class and their university to me. It was quite nice. And you know, from her class, there were a couple of, you know, of course, I shared my contact information. I was like, please reach out. There were a couple of students that were like keen to, again, work on their English and also act as a bit of cultural ambassadors,
mm-hmm.
who also, you know, reached out to me or stayed in contact. And then, you know, I had occasional meetings with them as well. And that was really nice because these were probably the only people my age,
uh-huh.
ultimately, that, you know, I was hanging out with, because the Russians were like, you know, even the younger, like the Russians that were studying, in China, they were generally a couple years older because they had, you know, finished their education and now they were studying the language or they had some trade-based business going on.
Uh-huh.
While, you know, these kids were, you know, they were like sophomores or freshmen or juniors in college. So they were sort of in the same boat as me. So, yeah, for sure, I interacted with the locals quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like those memories that I have that I share over a drink, you know, remembering fondly were definitely with
the foreigners, the Russians. So would you say that this experience in China, both with the locals and with the expats, sort of set you up on this trajectory of, you know, wanting to sort of learn about foreign cultures and immerse in foreign cultures and make foreign friends, maybe, you know, in your romantic relationships, you might, I don't know, might have a preference for foreign women. You know, would you say that this experience in China was transformative in some way in your life in that regard?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I was very lucky as an undergrad in the sense that actually almost every summer, I managed to get one of these fellowships to go abroad.
Oh, wow.
So I spent a summer. So the first one was the China one, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had one in Germany, on the western part of Germany near Cologne, in a research center called the Forschungszentrum Jülich. And then I had a summer in Japan in a city called Tsukuba, which is sort of the science city right next to Tokyo, linked directly by rail to Tokyo. Then I had China was before Japan. And then I had another summer in Germany, this time in Berlin.
Got it.
For sure, you know, I sort of knew from the beginning that I had a very strong interest in travel, in being abroad, in, you know, learning language and culture and sort of interacting with global people.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the China experience was very, very formative in that it launched a lot of sort of my interest to go, you know, to go into sort of less accessible places, right? Germany, people speak English in Germany, you know, you can understand, like as an American, going to Germany is not particularly,
difficult.
Culturally different, right?
Right.
Difficult, right? But China is a bit different. Japan is also a bit different, right? Even though Japan is very modern, very sophisticated, there's not a lot of English, and the language is, you know, very challenging as well.
Right.
So, yeah, for sure. But then, you know, when I was doing my graduate work, I was quite focused on PhD, and at the same time, I was focused on finding a job. So I didn't have any, not even travel. I didn't have vacation really during PhD times, right? Because I was either in the lab or, you know, I had like a summer internship at Lehman Brothers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I graduated, went to BCG again. You know, that took 100% of my time and energy.
Right.
But when this Samsung thing appeared, you know, going to Korea, I was like, you know, fuck yeah, like, what the hell? Yeah, I've been waiting for this, you know, for 10 years. I've been waiting to recreate my life as like a baller American.
So I want to unpack this baller American thing a little bit, right? So
yeah, sure.
When you were in Asia versus in Europe, by the way, I just got back from Europe myself. I was telling you earlier, got back from Greece and Italy. But and I know that you just spent some time in Spain as well. But,
indeed,
So like being an American in Asia versus Europe, right? So in Germany, for example, I mean, you're American. So nationality-wise, you're different. Language-wise, you're different. But appearance-wise, you kind of blend in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in Asia, I mean, you can't fool anybody that, you know, you're a local, right? So do you think that contributes to any kind of difference in your experience there as an expat?
Oh, yeah. you know, I mean, it's this is like highly self-centered, right?
Yes.
But ultimately, I think I'm, you know, quite an extrovert.
Uh-huh.
And I like to be the center of attention, which
sure.
is probably going to lead to all sorts of problems in the future, but or has already led to all sorts. But no, I'm joking. But, you know, it's definitely, at least for me, it's quite cool to stand out, but,
yeah.
you know, stand out in a positive way.
Sure.
Right? Maybe if I was in a place where they hated Americans or hated, you know,
Westerners.
White people than
right.
Westerners, then it would be, you know, it would probably not be the best place to stand out.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, being an expat in Asia and being an expat in Germany, or I would assume, you know, most of the rest of Europe, is a completely, completely different ballgame in terms of, you know, I think the kind of life that you have and the, you know, the attention that you get, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
here, especially, you know, Korea has foreign people, right? And has had for a long time, but there are not many Westerners running around here, right? So, you know, you do get like a very special attention by that, which is nice, right? Sometimes it's very unnecessary and unneeded,
uh-huh.
but often it's nice, right? People are very interested to
yeah,
be
absolutely.
Like, oh, what's this guy doing here?
Absolutely.
Like, I, you know, it's very funny because I am a member of this group in the World Economic Forum.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I was just in Hong Kong last week for a meeting, and I technically represent Korea because I joined the Korean group and I live here.
Uh-huh.
And so it's fantastic because, like, you know, I tell people, there are people who say, where are you from? Right. And I am Korean in the most technical sense of this discussion. I am Korean.
Got it.
Right. And people are like, so, you know, we're in Hong Kong, right. And you know, everyone is from all over the place, but by virtue of being a, you know, white guy, Western guy from Korea, I still get that, you know, that like attention, you know, I get that shot of adrenaline, you know.
They're probably
that
oh, you mean you're Croatian or something.
No, yeah. Korean. And so people are like, yeah, people be like, oh, so where are you really from? And I'm like, Korea. Like, it's not like I like transferred in Seoul to come here to Hong Kong. I live in Seoul, you know. And people are like, oh, get out of here. It's really funny. It's like a cute little thing, you know.
Got it.
So
is this group sort of like is it part of your company, or is it something that you've been involved with for a long time, or
a couple years? So so the world, let me just kind of give a
sure.
slight bit of background. So I'm sure you're familiar with the World Economic Forum.
Yes.
It's basically an organization that is based in Switzerland. I believe it's Geneva,
right.
although I'm sure like it's actually Lausanne, and I'm just got kicked out by saying this. and it, you know, ostensibly it is a forum. So it was started, you know, let's say 30 years ago or whenever by this guy who is like the Christ figure of the organization. Named,
Christ figure, okay.
What's Schwab, Professor Schwab, or
okay.
I think Klaus Schwab, who
okay.
people like talk about in hushed tones, like he is the, you know, the progenitor of our cult,
mm-hmm.
right? And he basically started this organization as a way for public, for companies, for the private sector, for the public sector, for NGOs, sort of for everyone to kind of get together and talk,
okay.
right, and kind of discuss major issues that are affecting the world and affecting their business or their policy or whatever. And it grew up very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the forum has a lot more than just the annual meeting in Davos, which is the famous thing. It also has different like groups of members, let's say. So you have like the kind of traditional forum members who are the CEOs, who are the companies, right? And the CEOs of those companies.
Mm-hmm.
And all the usual suspects are there, right? When they have the annual meeting, all the major, you know, Fortune 500 firms are there, most of them at least, along with government heads and so on.
Uh-huh.
And then, but you can imagine the age of, you know, those guys or ladies is, you know, in the 60s or whatever.
Right.
So then they started a group called the Young Global Leaders, although their definition of young was a little bit misaligned. So the Young Global Leaders are a group in their 40s, which I guess are young when you're 60,
right.
Who are like leaders of industry, again, private and public sector, you know, sort of one rung below these big CEOs. So, you know, these would be folks who are senior executives at large firms or, you know, have like a family business that they're primed to take or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the forum realized that, you know, these 40-year-olds are not really sort of, they don't really have their finger on the pulse of the upheavals of society.
Uh-huh.
So around the time, I guess this was around the time of the Arab Spring, so maybe 5-ish years ago, they started a new group called the Global Shapers. And to join the Shapers, you had to be, or still have to be, I think, before your, you have to join before your 30th birthday.
Okay.
So that's the cutoff. So this is mostly people in their mid to late 20s and then early 30s because it's a 5-year membership. And essentially, so I'm a Global Shaper.
Got it.
In Korea, I'm the first and only and likely last foreign shaper in Korea.
Okay.
Essentially, membership is sort of partially by application, partially by invitation. You know, technically anyone can apply.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem is most people don't know about it. I did not know about it until someone told me. And you know, people sort of invite their friends or something. But you know, basically it's an organization for young people that are, you know, doing well in whatever field they're in. So in Seoul, we have artists, we have, you know, business folks, we have NGO folks, we have like a lot of startup folks.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so it's a group, and we, our chapter is supposed to do something that has a social impact, right? You know, so I think in the past, they've done things like, I think they had a concert of some kind to raise charity, or raise money for charity. I think there was a, like a book that they were writing or something like that. I'm not really sure. I joined about 2 years ago, and we've been a little bit dormant as a chapter since then. But one of the nice things is that there are events globally. And shapers are invited to attend those events. So we have the global shape events, like Shape Asia was in Hong Kong last week. Earlier this year in Hiroshima, there was a shape event that coincided with the G7 meeting in Hiroshima.
Hmm.
There's like, you know, Shape Africa, Shape Europe, Shape North America. So they, you know, sort of the different branches all do their own thing. And it's quite fun, you know, you meet like really fascinating people that are similarly aged and, you know, they're all like doing something very cool. Hmm. And we also get to occasionally attend the big forum events. So last year I went to the World Economic Forum meeting, Asia meeting, which was in Jakarta last year. So the location changes. Except the main one. The main one in Davos never changes, but then the other events they do globally does. And it's very interesting to attend because you meet some kind of big guys, although like, you know, I don't feel like I have a lot to offer those big guys, so yeah, it's more like, you know, observation. But there are a lot of interesting panels and discussions, and you know, you learn a little bit about what's happening in your field and what's happening in maybe fields that are tangential or not even related, but you have an interest in, and so on.
So
the funny thing is,
go ahead.
I was going to say, the funny thing is, I first learned about the forum seriously when I was at BCG because we had a couple consultants that were seconded at the forum doing like basically writing reports that would be presented at the forum. And I worked on an internal project that basically the project was on financial innovation in emerging markets. Mm-hmm. So in other words, for example, when you don't have a credit rating, how do you determine the credit worthiness of an applicant for a loan, right? Mm-hmm. That's a big issue in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, North America. So some of the research that we had done basically made its way into a report that was ultimately presented at the forum, but I was, you know, not involved with that at all, except like very much on the periphery. But it was just interesting. That was sort of my little introduction. Little did I know that 3 years later, you know, or 3 or 4 years later, I would actually be at, you know, one of these meetings, like, you know, as a member and meeting the BCG guys, like technically as a potential client. So
incredible.
Kind of interesting how the world works.
Yeah, yeah. So this is incredible, right? So you're representing Korea as a global shaper in this organization. So, so you've been in Korea for about 3.5 years now, Tim, right? So what do you think? I mean, what is one thing, let's say, in Korean culture, in terms of work, in terms of relationships between people, that you think Americans can really benefit from learning?
Wow. I thought this question was going in a very different direction.
Oh, really? I mean the other way, which is...
No, I thought I was going to say the opposite. What's like one thing of Korean culture that drives you nuts?
Well, yeah, we could go that route too. You're going to answer that question after this one. Or if you don't have an answer to this one, you can do the other one first.
Well, for first, let me say, I realize we're supposed to talk about Korea and we're like an hour into
this conversation.
No.
We're not supposed to talk about anything. We can talk about anything. It's fine. This is very interesting. This is far more interesting than what I had originally had in mind. But go ahead.
I'm trying to think, what can people learn from Korean culture?
Yes.
I don't... So it's...
So the part of the reason why I'm asking you this question, right, to buy you some time, is because... I know that because in our prior conversations, you've talked about aspects of the Korean culture that you don't necessarily agree with, right? To put it lightly. So so I want to sort of turn the question around and see if there is anything. I mean, there's got to be something in the Korean culture that's distinct but also valuable for other cultures, right? Or no? Or maybe whatever culture is interesting or valuable there is not distinctly Korean. It's maybe Asian, maybe it's East Asian, maybe something else.
Yeah. So I think Korea. So let me kind of answer both questions in parallel.
Sounds great.
So I think in Korea, people are exceedingly, you know, hardworking and very motivated and very education focused and very family focused. And these are all, you know, aspects of like core aspects of the culture that, you know, ultimately I think, I don't know if it's distinctly Korean or it's Asian or it's whatever, but, you know, these are all things that, you know, we in the West probably can, you know, maybe do a little bit better, right? I don't think we have necessarily the reputation of being very, you know, family focused and education driven and so on. Although, you know, of course, that is true for a lot of people in the West, right? But I think kind of in parallel to that, the mechanisms by which this happens in Korea are not the best, right? Like, for instance, the education focus is driven by this extreme level of competition to enter the best, you know, the best middle school, to get into the best high school, to get into the best college, to get into Samsung so you can become like a cog in a massive machine and get, you know, develop an alcohol problem and hate the wife. Right. This is like, I just told you the summary of like everyone's life. Right. So you have these kids that are studying for, 18 hours a day that don't really have a life, that don't really have a lot of social skills, that, don't play sports or run around or do the things that probably you and I did as kids.
Right.
Right. But they're like really good at math. So it's like, okay, well, is that really the best thing for these kids? And parallel to that, they spend 12 years learning English, which is great. Like, I think language education is a massive issue in the West because, I learned Spanish for 4 years of high school, and as I learned on my trip to Spain, cannot put together a sentence, right? parallel to that, like, these kids, they kill themselves learning English in terms of reading and writing, mm-hmm. but they can't put together a sentence either because they can't speak.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I can't do it because I don't remember. They can't do it because they can't, verbalize.
Right.
Right. Because that's not part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. The hard work aspect, I think I was telling you about this when we met, but this country, this Seoul, this city, which is a top tier global city in every measure, uh-huh. and maybe the best in many measures of cleanliness, of efficiency, and so on, was built in 30 years. If you, there's this amazing set of photos that I think I told you about maybe, or if not, I highly recommend you find them.
Uh-huh.
They were taken of Seoul from the same vantage, 10 years apart, just over the Han River. And the first one was like 1960, and Seoul literally looks like a swamp. It's like a rice paddy that's bombed out, and you're like, what the fuck? Like,
right, right.
They had a lower GDP per capita than the Congo.
Uh-huh.
And literally within 30 years, you see skyscrapers start to be developed. Everything gets super clean, super modern. You look at it now, and you were here, right? It's a fantastic city.
Yeah.
And that is built on the work ethic, it's built on the backs of the Korean people. Like, there wasn't like some magic switch that someone pressed and all of a sudden, skyscrapers started popping up.
Right.
Right. And that's amazing. That's a miracle. You cannot take that away. But, people were like worked to death, like maybe not literally, but, the hours here for a lot of these salary men who are working for the big companies like Samsung or Hyundai or, LG or whatever, mm-hmm. are brutal. People don't really have a life outside of their work. They, mm-hmm. They just work until late, and then their boss says, hey, let's drink. And you cannot say no to your boss. You cannot ever question your boss. And then you go and you get real fucking wasted, come home, smelling of liquor. And your wife is like, what's the hell? And then you just fall down, hopefully on your bed, and repeat tomorrow.
Uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
Like, that's sad. A sad existence, yeah. Right? So, yes, there's something to be learned there. And I think, we definitely can and should try to learn something. But ultimately, like, this, this cultural, like, for example, in this case, this kind of pressure to work really hard, or not even hard, this pressure to just work really long hours, mm-hmm. and maintain FaceTime with your boss and not be able to have an independent opinion of your boss, mm-hmm. and so on is not very healthy.
Sounds
right?
Sounds similar to Japan too.
Yeah, I think Koreans, they have this very difficult relationship with Japan.
Sure.
Because they, Japan was the colonial power and committed all sorts of atrocities in Korea.
Right.
And Koreans still very remember, I think one difference between us in the West and maybe Eastern culture is that the memory here is a lot longer, right? We, you know, we fought a war in Germany, right? And, you know, I'm Jewish and you know, Jewish people suffered quite a bit, you know, at the hands of the Nazis. But I don't feel any animosity toward Germany or today's German people. I spent the 2 summers there. I have wonderful German friends that, you know, if anything, like, I like to joke about Nazis and all that, but, you know, and German efficiency. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I have absolutely no hate for them. And this is true from a lot of Jewish people. But here, even though the same amount of time has passed, today's Koreans, and it's changing, of course, but today's Koreans and Chinese, by the way, you know, still bear a big grudge to Japan. So that's kind of one side. But then on the other side, a lot of modern Korean culture has its foundation in Japanese culture and work ethic and style.
Right.
Like, if you look at exactly the work culture, is very similar, sort of the salaryman culture, the big conglomerates, even the industries, right? What is Korea, like, over the last several decades, what has Korea excelled at? Car making, heavy industries, electronics, shipbuilding, and so on. These are areas that Japan had dominated for a long, long time.
Right.
And now the major crisis is like this, the existential crisis that Korea is feeling is that Korea right now is on the path to a lost decade, just like Japan was 20 years ago. And no one knows, or maybe 25 years ago, and no one knows what to do, right? Because similarly to how Korea kind of pushed out Japan and priced out Japan and probably, you know, stole a lot of technology from Japan to muscle into these industries that historically were Japanese, China is doing the same to Korea. And similarly to how Japan, you know, never really figured out how to grow since that time, although Japan does have the advantage of having very high-tech niches where they are the, you know, the world number one, everyone trusts Japanese quality, right? Korea doesn't really even have that. Like, there's no, maybe with the exception of cosmetics and plastic surgery, there's no area in Korea where, you know, people are like, yes, made in Korea, that's the stamp of approval that I want. All at the same time, China is pushing into all the traditional areas. So there is this weird relationship with Japan that is very difficult to unpack, right? And then at the same time, young people like, you know, Japanese styles and so on. And actually these days, Korean pop music, Korean style, Korean brands are huge in Japan as well as the rest of Asia.
Right.
So it's all, you know, changing, but at glacial pay of paces.
Like that app Line, for example, is made by Koreans, right?
And it's mostly in Japan. It is. Yeah. Line is a really interesting story because, so in Korea, the main chat app or messaging app is an app called Kakao.
Kakao Talk, right?
That's right. And the origin, this is what I've heard, I have no way to confirm or deny it, but basically there was this guy, he was a tech entrepreneur, he you know, had some money, did a trip to America with his family, and discovered WhatsApp, right? And he was like, oh, this is brilliant. So he came back to Korea and was like, okay, I'm going to make the Korean WhatsApp. And he made, him and his business partners made Kakao. Kakao, you know, became massive. And around the same time, Naver, which is the biggest Korean, like, search portal engine, Google equivalent, but does a lot more, right? They were like, oh, okay, we should make a Kakao ripoff called Line. And it looked I don't know how it looks now, but initially Line looked like, you know, a reskinned version of Kakao. But what happened was in Japan they had that earthquake back, was it 2009 or 10? And 10. And the cell towers were knocked out, so they didn't have voice, but they had data. And folks started, like, people stayed in contact by messaging each other. And the app that, I don't know if this was because it was the only app available, or I'm not sure if it was serendipity or what, but the app that everyone got to stay in contact was Line.
Oh, interesting.
Which was actually a Korean-made app, but, you know, had been ported into Japanese prior. And so Line, you know, even eventually the cell towers came back, everything came back to normal. People had been communicating online in a very nice way, and they said, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. And they sort of stuck with it. And so now Line is the biggest Japanese messaging platform. And they went public. I believe Line went public in, I think, in parallel. Tell me if I'm wrong. They went public in Tokyo and on the NASDAQ? I might be lying, but I think they went public in both.
Yeah,
or at
probably.
Least in Tokyo.
Or even in, I think maybe even in Singapore. I don't remember. But
anyway, they are at least public in Tokyo, in Japan. And then Kakao basically merged or acquired Daum, which was the competitor of Naver.
Naver, right.
And went public here as Daum Kakao.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's just an interesting story. I don't know what it has to do with anything, but...
No, it's. I think it illustrates the prowess of Korean information technology, and it's sort of emblematic of everything else you've been talking about, how it's sort of, it's sort of threatened Japan in various ways in various industries. But now, it, you know, sort of China is catching on, and Korea could be in sort of this, you know, sort of between a rock and a hard place, or in a strange spot where it does not really have, as you mentioned, the way the Japanese do, sort of this niche that they can claim, right?
Yeah, and to be honest, the Japanese niche is not wonderful. Like Japan has been in what, stagnation or stagflation for 2 decades.
Right.
So it's even with this, you know, this kind of handful of areas where they are world leaders.
Mm-hmm.
China is gonna take over. I mean, even among the chatting apps, you probably have WeChat, right?
Yes.
Or was it? In Chinese, what, it's Weixin, or I forget what it's called in Chinese.
Weixin.
Yeah. That app actually is really good. Like Chinese people basically live their whole digital life in WeChat.
Yeah.
Right? And it has all of these kind of plugins and apps inside of the app that let you do everything you need to do, even transfer money to your friends.
You get taxis.
My Chinese friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, taxi.
Your Chinese friends transfer money and make payments this way, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's a lot more feature rich than WhatsApp, than Kakao, than Line, than
Facebook
probably
Messenger,
anything out there.
Yeah,
Facebook Messenger. Yeah. So that I think, you know, the main concern of WeChat that probably keeps it from going global is all those data are stored in some Chinese data center somewhere, and you know, the government is searching through your communications to see if you're saying anything subversive, right?
Exactly.
But if they ever figure out how to, you know, make like a separate but equal global version or what, I can see WeChat becoming, you know, a much more global platform and threatening the ones we just listed.
Yeah, I think on that note, by the way, I think recently there's a New York Times article talking about how Chinese startups, these online mobile startups, when they start out, they actually have to make a decision which side of the wall they want to be on. So sort of if they want to sort of build off WeChat's infrastructure, a lot of the stuff will sort of be compatible with other stuff that's within China's firewall, right? So if these companies eventually want to go abroad and go global, it's going to be a little tougher. Whereas if you make this decision that you're just going to basically, you're going to leverage off, let's say, Facebook's infrastructure, right? Or Google's infrastructure to do something, then you're sort of targeting customers and users abroad from day one. But it's very difficult to sort of claim both sides of the wall, so to speak.
Exactly. And there's also a financing aspect as well, because China domiciled companies are a little bit more difficult to invest into, because you need to invest in renminbi and the currency, and setting up a renminbi-based account is not very simple.
Right.
So what a lot of companies do is that they make these either they just domicile abroad, which is fine, or if you look at the publicly traded Chinese companies like, Sina or I'm not sure what are the other ones.
Baidu
is another one.
Yeah, Alibaba. Or
I'm not sure Alibaba's exact structure, but at least Baidu and Sina, they have this like special legal vehicle that's created called, I think, a VIE or VEI or something, which is basically they have a holding company in Hong Kong that through a lot of legal gymnastics kind of owns technically, but not really, the Chinese company. And then foreign investors invest in the holding company. And there's this very complicated structure that basically allows folks like venture capitalists abroad or investors abroad to enter the Chinese or to invest in particular Chinese companies without having to make renminbi denominated accounts and, go through all these kind of archaic and complex legal structures.
Right.
So yeah. it's a big question for them, and there's definitely benefits to both sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot ignore the WeChat infrastructure, but at the same time, do you want to ignore the rest of the world?
Right.
From a user perspective, from a financing perspective, right?
Exactly. So, so Tim, there's so many other topics that I really wanted to go through with you. I think that we may have to do a second installment of this interview. So, for example, like venture capital, right, in Korea and elsewhere, and let's say dating and relationships, in Korea, and just as an expat in Asia in general, etc. And lots of other topics I wanted to discuss. So, so maybe we should do another round of this at some point, if you're available. And,
sure.
So I think as a close to this particular installment, I wanted to sort of close with one question. And it's a bit of a thought provoker, I guess. Mm. And that is, so let's suppose you are to give advice to... I want to say the 20-year-old self, but at the time you were kind of in Beijing and you were sort of hanging out with these Russian semi-mafia people. So I don't know if that's a good... you were sort of busy with these things. So let's say you were to give advice to the Tim that just graduated from college.
Mm.
What one piece of advice would you give to him today?
Interesting. So It's weird because, and my memory is not great, but I would say that, the life that I've lived over the past, 10 years, let's say since I've graduated from college.
Yes.
Holy shit, it's been 10 years. Wow.
Yeah,
10 years. Time flies. It does fly. It's been quite good. Like I don't, and I say this, with an extreme amount of wood that I'm knocking on, like there hasn't been like a situation where I would be like, God damn, if I had only not, pressed that button, I would be a billionaire today and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there are a couple of things I could have done, should have done better. I think, for example, during the PhD time, I was so focused on getting out of there, right? And I don't know how, Robbie, you did the PhD as well, right? I don't know how you felt, and I'm curious.
Sure.
But for me, I sort of realized quite early on that I'm a shitty scientist.
Yeah.
to put things lightly. And so I viewed, like, I want to have the distinction, the, you know, the brand, the title that the PhD confers, but I did not want to be a scientist, a researcher. I would have loved to be a professor, but I also, you know, realized that the odds of becoming a faculty member at a good institution are, you know, minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just sort of really spent, this is maybe a different conversation topic, but I spent my whole PhD time trying to get out of PhD unsuccessfully. kind of looking at the next thing, when I could have probably spent more time, you know, maybe immersing myself, not just in academia, but in the sort of the freedom that I had at the time. Like, for example, trying a startup to see, or, you know, if I could launch something on my own, or, you know, learning about a few other things that I never had a chance to do or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah.
So
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. But that's one thing that I wish I had, that I would tell myself that I think I had done different. I wish I had done differently.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is, I don't know, like I'm always curious if I could have handled my BCG time a bit differently, because it was my first job. It's a very competitive, highly political place where half the folks, you know, get fired every year.
Oh,
not
wow,
fired,
know
you know, canceled out or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, most folks are coming in with work experience and all that out of you know, MBA or whatever, and in my case, this was literally my first job, and I was 25 years old.
Right.
So, I think there are probably a lot of things that I could have done differently from a professional political perspective that would have made my BCG life a lot less stressful, because that was a time that, you know, I was just always on the edge, just always incredibly stressed, working not happy hours, you know, having like random, like not conflicts, but kind of conflicts with, you know, other folks at BCG. Like nothing that ultimately was a big problem, but definitely things that could have been done differently. And, you know, my relationship, personal relationship suffered quite a bit at the time, and, you know, from a physical perspective, I was, you know, drinking 5 cups of coffee a day.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it was definitely, you know, not the fondest time of my life that I look back on. And there were things that I don't regret going, that's for sure. I would definitely have gone through and done, you know, done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, there were definitely, I think, areas that I should have been much better prepared for professionally.
Right,
that's
right.
For sure.
So this concludes my interview with Tim. Till next time.